This is the Motion Martial Arts Podcast. In this episode, we discuss training with a growth mindset. Thanks for listening.
What's up, everybody?
We're back.
Today we're going to talk about growth mindset, which obviously can mean a few different things, but I think we'll just jump right into it. I personally think one of the biggest thing with training with a growth mindset is that your training itself can't you can't waste your time in your training.
Yeah.
So if you have a growth mindset, you understand the value of showing up focused and ready to go. And that focus, for me personally, I'm somebody who, like, from the gate, I need to come in with a certain attitude and mindset or my whole day of training is kind of thrown off.
Yeah.
So, like, I think it comes in personally for me, it's like understanding the value of why a warm up exists, and then taking a approach of, even if you are learning a technique that maybe you've seen before, or a technique that you don't think will be something that's beneficial to your game, understanding why it's important to drill it with seriousness.
Yeah.
And then from there, it continues then across the board of, like, why it's important to focus on specific things in your training and how that will improve you and
sure.
how that will help you grow, versus kind of just being haphazard about the whole thing and just coming in and be like, yeah, I'm just here to, because I want to break a sweat.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that comes to my mind is like the work smart, not hard type of mentality, which I think sometimes is a little too reductionist. It's not that you shouldn't work hard, but I understand the point. You can be working really, really hard, but if you're not working in, like, a smart, efficient way, then you're not necessarily going to get better, you know.
Former guest Josh Hinger, he made a post on his Instagram a while ago talking about kind of saying that he doesn't like that statement, actually.
Yeah.
The work smart, not hard. And his point was kind of what you just said there.
Sure.
Like, if you are working smart, you should be working hard.
Definitely.
Yeah. Like it shouldn't be replacing working hard. It
kind of creates a false dichotomy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, smart and hard don't go together, which they do. But I understand, I think, the point behind it is just that, like, you can be working really, really hard, but working in an inefficient way, and you won't get the benefit like that. And, you know, so kind of comes into a key thing to think about with this one. It's just, like, comfort zones. You know, it's like what you want to be doing in your training is pushing yourself hard enough that, you know, you're consistently leaving, you know, like, your comfort zone, and therefore you're giving yourself room to grow, but not so hard that you're taking unnecessary risks and therefore opening yourself up to potential injury.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So, I've been training. I've been doing jiu-jitsu a lot more lately, and, you know, coming as a total novice with that thing, everybody has been warning me quite a bit. They said that, you know, like, white belts have a tendency to hurt themselves or hurt others in their training,
and
you don't wanna. And it's just kind of like, it's good to have mentality going in that just, like, don't, you know, you're trying to learn good technique here. Don't just try to muscle everything and go hard, because that's not always helpful.
So I think the white belts are the most dangerous thing. It's true to a certain extent, but I also think it's false. I think whoever you are as a person is going to shine through in your trainings, particularly when you're going live trainings or sparring.
Sure.
So, like, it's like if you're aggressive and you don't really care about what happens in training outside of getting your win, and I'm doing quotation marks that you guys can't see right now because there literally is no such thing as winning in training. If you want to go win something, I've said this before, go compete. Training is training. It's there to improve. And it's not that you don't go with super hard sometimes, but there should be a focus to the training.
Mm-hmm.
I think that most of the injury stuff happens, I think it's, so white belt, it's obviously a little bit more dangerous because you don't know what you're doing sometimes. You don't know what you don't know.
Sure.
But I think that same thing can happen with any belt. And that's my personal opinion from training. It's that you have some guys that are so focused on getting taps in training that they don't care, and they'll do dangerous stuff and mindless stuff because in the heat of the moment, they get so worked up in this idea of catching people. And again, that is not a growth mindset.
Sure.
To me, that's actually detrimental long term. And I have days where I come in and I'm like, man, I got to smash and kill and destroy and crush everything in front of me.
Yeah.
And that's the focus for that day. But that can't be your focus every time you train. Sometimes, in my opinion, it's a balance, and it's writing down very specific goals, like being like, today is nobody will pass my guard day.
Mm-hmm.
Next day might be, okay, I need to set up Kimuras. I'm working focused on Kimuras and Kimura traps. Those of you that don't train jiu-jitsu or grappling, this might not make any sense to you, but we can
work on specific things. Techniques. Yeah. You're focusing on it for something specific. Yeah.
And then it can be an offensive thing. It can be a defensive thing. It can be a little more open-ended. It can be hyper-focused. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the striker. It can be like, hey, right now I need to work on establishing the jab.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a bad job of using the jab to manage distance the whole time.
Yep.
And I need to focus on that because there's a ton of great things that happen from setting up my jab. Hey, I really never focus on leg kicks. And probably the leg kick is one of the best things I can have is from a self-defense standpoint as a strike.
Yep.
So I need to focus on leg kicks more and body kicks instead of head kicks. It's like simple things like that. And then, but just every once in a while, you need to be like, hey, today's goal is just to crush everybody in training.
Sure.
Today's goal is, hey, I need to get a cardio session in because I'm going to compete soon. So I'm going to just make sure that I'm active and not stalling at any point and not resting so I can get my heart rate up. Today's goal is defense. So I'm going to be elusive the whole time. I want to get in and out safely. This is obviously from a striking perspective, but to a certain extent, from a jiu-jitsu perspective as well. Sure. Like, again, to me, it's having a focus goal and a focus plan every time you step in to train.
Yeah.
Not just, I'm here to train. I'm here. This is my exercise. And it's fine if that is what you're doing it for. If you're just there for exercise, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Everybody has their different reasons for training. But in my opinion, if you might hurt your ability to improve as quickly as some of your peers in the room if that's your training approach.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I definitely, still totally new to jiu-jitsu, but I just feel like from recent experiences that I've had, when you have, when you're such a beginner, such a novice, you don't have a lot of, technique to fall back on. It's like, it's easy just to try to muscle it, because that's something you have available to you.
Well,
you just try to push and resist hard.
I think it depends who you are. And those of you that train me and know me personally, some of you know that I milk it a little bit when I say how weak I am.
Yeah.
But I'm not a very big guy still. But I'm probably stronger than I think I sometimes allude to.
You're pretty athletic. You're in good shape. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is that I felt early on, because most of my physical abilities and gifts came from jiu-jitsu, and I didn't come into jiu-jitsu with them. I personally felt like, for me, using more strength, using more speed wasn't going to get me anywhere. So, I mean, I still get smashed and beat up all the time, but it used to be a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of came in with the perspective as a white belt being like, hey, this is just going to be the way it is. But if I focus on using the actual techniques that I know from these positions, I will improve at a faster rate.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm getting extra reps in. And I think some of that comes from being a musician.
Yeah.
And those of you that haven't checked out a past episode, I recommend listening to the episode I did with my longtime friend Brett. Because Brett has never done martial arts, but he has a lot of dedication to practicing routines and practicing for growth through skateboarding and music.
Mm-hmm.
I think being a musician helped me walk in with a kind of growth mindset to begin with. And this is where all the arts start to connect. So I kind of have gone through a path where, again, I think I've said this before on this podcast and different episodes, I am by no means of the imagination what anybody would consider a great musician, a great player. But I'm definitely above average as a player, you know? So the thing is that I understood from music that, hey, if you want to improve, you can't just sit around and play other people's songs.
Yeah.
You have to practice scales and you have to be dedicated to it. While everybody else is going out and hanging out on a Saturday night, you might have to go to band practice.
Sure.
You need to get together with the people that are your peers and you know, focus on writing something and be okay with saying, hey, I invested we've been practicing this song for 6 months thinking it was going to be on a record, and it's actually garbage, so let's just trash the song. Same thing with jiu-jitsu. So I again, this carried over to jiu-jitsu, where it's like, sure. Oh, I've been using this technique for 8 months and it's worked, but it actually only worked because the other people I was training with sucked.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what to do. So this thing is not a universal technique.
I could definitely relate to that. That's like, you know, rolling with another white belt, that it's just, they can kind of tell that, like, yeah, you know, but, able but to catch it, things, because we're both doing a lot of dumb stuff.
But it comes back to any of the striking arts as well. Like, it's sure. like, because, like, the thing is that an unskilled person is going to react completely different than a person that's showing up to train who has little bit of skill.
Absolutely.
So, like, the thing is like, they want to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
Where an unskilled person who you get into a street fight altercation with does not want to play the game.
Yeah.
Because they don't even know the game.
Sure, yeah. Even as a total novice, you're creating this kind of, like, artificial context.
Exactly. So it's like you might be getting away with, hey, they're coming in, I'm able to hit them with an inside leg kick because of how they're coming in. But the only reason why that inside leg kick exists is because they're taking a stance that is for their own striking ability.
Yeah.
That stance might not exist if they aren't an actual skilled striker.
Not just bum rushing you. Exactly. You know, big haymakers, you know, they're keeping their distance and circling, you know, so you get, creates maybe an opening for a shot
So, again, speaking from a striker perspective, both of you need space to get your strikes off.
Sure.
So an unskilled person might not have that knowledge and understanding, so they might get in so close that they kill their own ability to throw a power strike and your ability to throw a strike of power. So again, they don't even know the rules of the game. They don't even understand the game.
Yeah.
So it's a huge different perspective. But somebody who is training, they're playing the rules of the game to a certain extent, even if they don't know all of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you might start to get into this false sense of, hey, this thing works.
Yeah.
And then you find out later it doesn't. And I think I've had this conversation with you before, but I don't think we've ever talked about it on a podcast. One of the hardest things as an instructor is, when you teach kids,
mm-hmm.
is when you have a kid that is super athletic, has the aggressive go-getter, I want to win attitude, because you'll see all the time they are doing something that does not work, but it is working for them. And then you have to tell them, listen, hey, I'm telling you, I see that it's working right now, but long-term, it doesn't work if it's an unskilled person, because they're not going to give you that behavior, and it doesn't work
against people super skilled.
If they're skilled and they know what they're doing. What you're taking advantage of is that these other kids are timid and they're trying to play the game, but they're the kids that really need the martial arts.
Sure.
So you're just winning because you're so much physically better than them. And you see this look of like, but it worked.
Yeah.
So it's almost like they don't care what you're saying, because like, but it worked. And you're like, I'm telling you it worked because you are physically stronger than this person. And if you get into a fight, it's almost certain that the person you were fighting with will be more physically strong than you. I'm telling you, against somebody who's skilled, who knows the game, it's not going to work. And they're kind of like, I don't believe you almost.
Yeah.
I don't believe you.
Yeah.
And again, this comes back to the growth mindset, because people that are open-minded and understand, hey, this person is my instructor for a reason.
Yeah. And they're not recognizing that they're in a comfort zone there. That, you know, it's like it's working because you're not in it. You're not being challenged the way that you will be and that you need to be in the future. So I think, being kind of future oriented in your training is big and important. And I'm sure you can think about that as a musician too, that, you know, you have to have some kind of vision for yourself of where you're going rather than just where you are now.
So again, it depends what you want to get out of everything.
Yeah.
And so martial arts, in my opinion, is different than some of the other arts, because martial arts have a health perspective that the other arts don't. And this is not a knock on any of the other arts, because I love all of the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably am, as much as I love martial arts, I'm probably even more passionate about music than I am the martial arts. And the music thing has been something that's, you know, been a part of my life for God knows how long now. But like, the thing is that martial arts and training for self-defense, it's kind of like eating healthy.
Yeah.
It might not always be glamorous, it might not always be fun, but it's an essential skill.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't dictate if or when you will be in a self-defense situation. You can try to make better decisions that avoid those things, but to a certain extent, we can't control when violent acts happen against us.
Yeah.
We can try and make good decisions to limit the opportunities for those events as much as possible. But again, we only have so much control over it at the end of the day. So to me, it's kind of like, and for parents who have kids that are training, or if you're somebody who sometimes wavers back and forth, like you're kind of like, yeah, I don't love this sort of thing. I think you have to take a perspective of it being good for you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And
why would you compare that to like playing scales as a musician? That's like, because I've been playing guitar for 2 years, so I'm, again, a super novice with music too. But I can also appreciate that it takes discipline to practice.
So I think all the arts have benefits and values. And I think that, like, you know, playing music, doing drawing, writing things has like a mental health aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that, and mental health is definitely something that's important.
Yeah.
The difference is that self-defense is for if you ever are attacked physically.
Life protection.
Yeah, and if it's not something that you keep sharp,
yeah,
it erodes. It's just a fact of nature.
It's the same way we were talking about, though, that, you know, and we've talked about this in the past, previous episodes, I think the one that we did that was on, you know, training for self-defense specifically. It's that, you know, like the self-defense stuff is like the sport is fun. It's very engaging, and that's why I said that, like, although I consider myself a martial artist that has that, you know, a self-defense focus to what I do, I also acknowledge that, like, most of what I do really is more sport related, though, because, you know, like, it's important that you have the self-defense aspect of what you do, and you have to have that as a daily part of your training, just a regular thing. You're always practicing things that are specifically geared towards self, you know, protection against a criminal assault. However, you know, like, what really engages you in your training and keeps you, makes it like fun and enjoyable for me anyway, I would say for most people, is the sport aspect of it. Is, you know, the techniques that are for outfighting another martial artist. You know, it's like, that's the part. Yeah. Part that's fun. And I say, maybe just to bring it, because I like the comparison, you know, like with music, you know, like playing other people's songs, like learning how to play a song you love, you know, I'm sure it's fun. It's like a fun thing to learn how to do. Course, and you definitely get some benefit from it. However, you know, learning actual music theory and, you know, like, and being good with scales and stuff like that, probably it's a more like essential skill.
I don't think that I've actually sat down and tried to learn somebody's song on probably bass or guitar now and, I mean, at least 10 years. It's probably longer than that. There's, gotcha, like, joking around.
You've been a musician for, what, 20 years? Something like that? More?
So, I mean, Rosetta formed in 2003, and I obviously had some bands before that.
Yeah.
So it's been a while.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, like, Rosetta was really the beginning for me of, like, hey, all we do is play our songs ever. So it's like, there's lots of times we're at the practice space, we're joking around and playing, and like, you're just playing your instrument and you're like, oh, this is like, you hit a note and you're like, oh yeah, this is this band's thing. And then you just start playing their thing as a joke. And you're like,
yeah,
I'm joking around. I'm playing this song by this person. Ha ha ha. Funny sort of thing. But like sitting down, actually being like, oh, I'm going to learn somebody's song. It's been a while.
Yeah.
And I used to do that when I was like in middle school and high school and first starting to play guitar first back then. I was like, yeah, dude, I want to learn the Alice in Chains songs. I want to learn the Nirvana songs.
Sure.
I want to learn, like, yeah, the stuff that I grew up to liking, Smashing Pumpkins. But then it's like more and more, once you are kind of like, well, man, I want to do my own thing. I appreciate what these people are influences for me, but I want to do my own thing. You start spending less and less time focused on their songs. You're like, well, I need to run my scales a little bit. I need to play chords. I want to sit down and, like, after I've warmed up, like, just, like, kind of mess around on my instrument and write something myself.
Yeah. It's interesting because, yeah, have you read the Book of Five Rings, right? Musashi, great quote, very famous one, where it says something like, he who understands the way broadly can see it in all things. And that's just, you know, what you're talking about, comparing martial arts to music, you know, it's, at the end of the day, there's so much overlap, despite the fact that they're completely different pursuits in a real fundamental way. But it's still, that's interesting, looking at that kind of stuff, because I really, And another one that we've talked about on here plenty of times before is the idea of kind of like, I think somebody, like, you get to a point that you've trained for a long enough time period. I really think that it makes sense for most practitioners, especially somebody that's in a position like I am, where it's like, it's my job and it's kind of what I've dedicated my life to, that I'm not just trying to learn what other people do. I'm trying to develop my own unique approach to martial arts training, which is why doing things like, you know, my style, my background is in Tangsudo, Korean karate, right? And, you know, and for a solid, you know, 15 years, that was all that I did. And I got to the point that, you know, I was pretty good at it. And then it's like, but where do you go from there? And I think that with a lot of people, you just fall, like, again, to talking about the growth mindset, that you, it becomes, you're no longer out of your comfort zone, you know? And this might be a little bit of a controversial take on things, but, like, I don't know if it makes sense for most people to practice a single art for their whole life, that, you know, you can, I think that people actually tend to exhaust an art. That gets to the point that you fall into a routine.
To a certain extent, I think that's true.
Yeah, I just think that for a lot of people, I think, and you know, I'm not saying that you can't, there aren't, of course, always things that everybody's going to be able to improve, so, but it stops being as engaging often when you get to a certain point. And that's when things like cross training, I think, are a really good option for people.
Well, the thing is again, so just the way that jiu-jitsu works in the gi is that the gi is more or less like having a rope attached to somebody. Mm-hmm. So, like, there is so many different combinations you can use of this rope that the possibilities in jiu-jitsu are a little bit more than some of the other martial arts. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that most of that stuff is obviously very sports focused, but you have a lot much larger path where you can take it. And it's kind of the same thing with music. Like, you might be somebody who has a, who maybe likes, we'll use metal as an example, and you really love metal, you play metal, well, you can go out and learn classical guitar. Mm-hmm. And then after you learn classical guitar, you can learn how to play the blues. And then after the blues, you can go do jazz.
Sure.
And after jazz, you can do funk. Mm-hmm. After funk, you can do R&B. So, like, the thing is that there is, I think, a lot more open-endedness with jiu-jitsu than some of the other martial arts, just because of how the kimono, the gi jacket is used.
Well, I think it might be a little bit, and again, you know, a little bit out of my expertise.
To jiu-jitsu, though, but with the jacket. Sure. So you notice I didn't say without the jacket, because without the jacket, you're much more limited. Mm-hmm. You're much more limited because you have to think about our kimono tops. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about just grappling, when there's no threat of getting struck in any way, so there's no chance of getting punched, kicked, headbutted, kneed, elbowed, whatever, it's just a giant rope.
Yep.
And you can use the rope in so many different combinations. Yeah. And that's where we've seen, if you actually look at most of the innovations in jiu-jitsu, it's been that. Yeah. And the other big innovation for people that do or don't train has been leg locks as of late. Mm-hmm. But that's just because the leg locks before were considered cheap and dirty, and now that's not necessarily the case. But even still, again, there's only so many options when you take the kimono off of what you can do with the leg. So it kind of shuts the door of the possibilities.
My impression is that jiu-jitsu just kind of has a little bit of a little more open, like, it's like a cultural thing with that art, where it's not as, like, somebody who's a background in karate and, you know, think it's, I'm sure karate is a big art in a lot of different ways that it's practiced, but generally there's, like, this militant kind of aspect of it where, like, things are very standardized and, you know, you practice exactly this way and there are things that you don't do. And the term for this often is called style limitations. The idea, so for instance, like, let's say I want to add leg kicks to my practice. Now, it's not that, like I'm not doing Tangsudo anymore because I'm kicking people in the legs. Like, I understand, like, that's kind of a ridiculous statement. However, it's not something that's particularly common in Tangsudo. You know, obviously when you think of, like, of striking arts that do leg kicks, what comes to mind first is Muay Thai. You know,
I guess the issue is, and I guess this is what it comes down to, is that, and I hope I don't offend anybody with this, that to a certain extent, the striking arts have more of a mindset approach problem than an actual open-ended skill acquisition problem. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm a boxer, I'm doing striking, mm-hmm. and it should be much easier for me to start having an understanding of adding elbow strikes, headbutts, shoulder strikes, yeah. knees, kicks, stomps. All that stuff should be much easier for me to add than somebody who's a wrestler or a jiu-jitsu or a grappler of some sort, sambo, sure. whatever, judo.
There are definitely some body mechanics that are going to transfer.
But yeah. there's just like a lack of, it's like, I'm a boxer, so I'm only going to focus on boxing. And we're not going to do any of that kicking stuff. Mm-hmm. If I do taekwondo, I'm not going to do any of the kneeing or elbowing stuff. Mm-hmm. If I'm Muay Thai, I will do that stuff. But when I kick, I won't kick with the foot. I only kick with the shin. Mm-hmm. And some of this is, again, the growth mindset.
Sure.
And it's, for whatever reason, it's like, this is our thing. This is what makes us good. Yeah. This is what we specialize in. We're not going to focus on anything else. Yeah. And then if you want to do that other striking style, go to another gym.
Yeah. And, you know, so I think this is really interesting with this topic specifically, that like introducing limitations in your training. Like, no, we don't do those things. We only do these things.
Yeah.
I think especially for beginners and like intermediate, you know, I'm not saying like, you know, so my like 19-year-old self, when I was like really delving in hard the Tung Soo Do, you know, when I decided I wanted to be a teacher and I was training yeah. like 6 days a week and I was learning, you know, the typical Tung Soo Do type practice. It's like that. I think that there's some utility to the idea that, you know, you have these big limitations as to what you're doing. So you're developing specific things to a very high level. It's that specialization concept.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that. But I think at some point, for most people, if you continue to practice, I think that there's diminishing returns that come with that. I think it gets yeah. to a point that you develop those skills to a high level. You know, yeah, you can always go higher. You can always make it better in some way. But it stops being as engaging for you or something. I think that often, like, a good way to reintroduce that growth mindset yourself to, you know, to get out of your comfort zone, just be like, I want to learn leg kicks.
Yeah.
Or it's like, I want to learn some jiu-jitsu. You know, groundwork seems like it's important. It's the kind of thing that, you know, it's like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dude, like, I think that kind of thing for the right kind of practitioner, you know, because of course, like, if I look at, you know, I'm a teacher, I have students, like a 16-year-old kid that comes to mind that I teach who's been training for about 3 years. You know, it's like, I don't know if that's what's best for his training right now, is to go off and try to learn something completely different, because he's still trying to build a foundation and develop yeah. his foundational skills and everything like that. But 10 years from now, if he's still training, you know, I think that's the kind of thing that probably would be great for him. It's like, yeah, you should go out and you should cross train, you should do other stuff.
Yeah. So I agree with what you're saying there, but yeah. I also think that people can start with that growth mindset earlier than that.
Oh, sure.
And that again comes to what I was saying with coming in with a plan.
Yeah.
And depending on who you are, some people need to write that down. Some people it's just in their head. You know, you have to know yourself. But like, you should, in my opinion, break it down to the fact that you like, this is my overall goal for the year.
Yeah.
This is, and then like my month-to-month goals. And then my week-to-week goals, and then my day-to-day goals. I'm a huge believer in this approach. And yeah. it's not always about trying things. Sometimes it's actually about limiting yourself. So
sure, I'll yeah. Well, that's the idea. The limitations, sometimes there's it's functional to ensure. I mean, because ideally, you should always be trying. I agree with you 100% that you should always have a growth mentality.
Yeah.
I think sometimes introducing, you know, limitations in training, like I'm a total novice in jiu-jitsu, and I think having some limitations in my training is probably a good thing, you know, but yeah. at the end, but I think that depending upon where you're at, you know, when you do develop and you reach that next stage, I think that those same limitations are no longer fostering like a growth mindset with you, and they become instead something that's limiting you. You've outgrown it
yeah.
to a certain extent. I think it's important to think about those
things. I'm going to use something that I am super, super confident in my ability to elbow escape from the mount. Mm-hmm. I will put that move on the line against anybody in the world.
Yeah.
Now, it's a different conversation on how good or bad people think it is to be, have your best thing in jiu-jitsu be escaping the mount, but that's a different conversation for a different time. But I decided, this is maybe a year ago, maybe a little longer, I was like, okay, so I pretty much have fallen into the habit of elbow escaping everybody because I'm so confident and I know I can get out. So I'm not going to do any elbow escaping for, I think I it was like 4 weeks or 6 weeks. It was
take
like,
away, no elbow take escapes. Away your best tool.
No elbow escapes because it is like, I need to have the ability to do other mount escapes and get those to a certain level. And I know if I do this, my elbow escape will become even better when I start to add it back in, because I'll have this ability to actually, if it fails, have the confidence to transition one of these other escapes. And it sucked.
Yeah.
But then everything became better as a result of it, as far as escaping the mount.
Perfect example of introducing limitation for the interest of fostering growth.
So again, it all comes down to, though, not caring about winning or losing in training, which I've said multiple times, there is no such thing as winning or losing or training.
Yeah.
The only thing that you should be focused on in training is growth and improvement.
Yeah.
So if you're focused on growth or improvement and your goal is, hey, my goal is to not have my guard passed for 6 weeks. Well, your guard's going to get passed at first, but then over time, if that's your focus, it's like you don't really care what happens the rest of the time you're training, as long as your guard doesn't get passed.
Yeah.
So if your guard doesn't get passed and every time you get on top, you end up in the other person's guard and you get submitted, well, guess what? You've accomplished your goal every time you trained. If your goal is to, hey, I really want to improve my, and again, this is specific to jiu-jitsu, and I'll throw in a striking example in a second. If my goal is, hey, I want to get to neon belly and I want to be able to control neon belly for 20 seconds on everybody for the next 2 months, well, then every time you're doing that, you've succeeded. You've won. You've met your goal. So again, everything that doesn't mean you're lazy the rest of the round and you don't care about everything else that happens, but you've accomplished your goal. And then probably what you're going to see is a huge improvement in that ability to use neon belly to open up transitions to other positions, attacks, your confidence and feeling comfortable there. Same thing. If your goal is, hey, I want to be able to get in and out with a jab, and I want to be able to use that tool a lot, and I need to improve because that's a weakness. Well, at first you're going to be exposing yourself to bad things and you're going to get countered. But then over time, you're going to start to improve your ability of getting in and out with the jab, and the next thing you know, it's working for you all the time.
Yeah.
And again, it all comes from a growth mindset and not being afraid to lose.
Yeah, well, having the ability to kind of kill your ego with it a little bit, that's not about, and this is what I tell my students all the time, that, you know, it's like, we compete with each other as a way to motivate ourselves. It's a training tool with it that way. But the first competition is always you against yourself.
Yeah.
The idea that you're trying to be better than you were yesterday, better than you were before. And that's, you know, that's, in my opinion, a real, you know, just fundamental idea that has very closely related to this concept of growth mindset, is that at the end of the day, you're trying to outdo yourself. And as long as, you know, you kind of keep that the main goal that you have, then you're able to handle, you know, kind of losing to your training partners. It's like, because it's not what the real goal is
in your training. So my instructor is Huron Gracie, who is I think he's actually Elio Gracie's first grandson. He had this thing that he came under heat for, that he started now, I guess, probably like 8 years ago, called the Keep It Playful movement in jiu-jitsu. And I think the biggest thing that was happening, based off talking to him about it in person, but also, you know, really understanding what he was saying when he would talk about it, was that people thought that he was meaning like play around in training, which is not what he meant by it. What he meant by keep it playful was allow yourself to be put in these bad positions and be okay with tapping as long as you are present and you understand what's going on.
Sure.
And the same thing is if you're in an attacking position.
Yeah.
Don't attack, submit somebody, and then when somebody's like, what did you just do there? You're like, oh, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, that is defeating the purpose of why we train.
Mm-hmm.
So, I again, you can argue about calling it keeping it playful.
Oh, no,
I think that a better way to describe it is keeping it present.
Mm-hmm.
So being present in the moment of your training, not keeping it playful per se, but keeping it yourself present.
Dude.
So don't lose yourself so much in this desire to win and not be put in bad spots, not get submitted, like, I need to crush everybody, kill everybody. I need to get the tap. I cannot be tapped. I cannot be put in these bad spots. I need to keep everybody in a bad spot is being present. So everything you do, you understand how you did it. And everything that's being done to you, even if it's a new move, yeah, you're at least present enough that you're like, oh, I see what he did to me there.
Yeah.
Because that is one of the quickest paths for improvement and growth.
Sure. Yeah, well, there's a guy who I've talked about on the podcast many times before, and Rory Miller.
Yeah.
Big fan of his books. I've been lucky enough to train with him once. But he, at the seminar I attended of his, he actually talked about the concept of play and that how that's how people, that's it's a very efficient way to learn. And he's like, you know, like the, if you look at animal behavior with it a lot, like, cats. I grew up with cats. I've been around them a lot. It's like, how do cats learn how to hunt? When they're kittens, they play.
Yeah.
That's what they do. You know, it's like, that's how you, it's, especially with something like martial arts related, it's like combat oriented. I mean, let's be honest. Like, that's what sparring is. Yeah, we're supposed to be preparing for like combat of some sort, right? And yet we're not trying to injure each other. It's play. That's what it is. Yeah, that's what it is. It's a game
attack, pretty much. Yeah.
And there's like, and so I think having that mindset, I think, is very helpful. It's like, yeah, you're just playing, you know, because I think that, and so that, I think this actually ties in really well to what I think is a really important point, and I'd love to hear what you would say about it. But like, people that don't want, that only want to spar with people they know they can beat.
Yeah.
That's a big problem that you have often. That, yeah, you know, a lot of time that you have, or maybe sometimes, this is my experience as an instructor, like you might have a student who, of course, when I spar with them, you know, like I'm, of course, teaching them and you're like not winning against me in that way. But they're very, very hesitant about getting out there and going at, you know, like they'll fight hard with me. And I feel like they really, or fighting at their best and expressing themselves.
They've gone and mentally been, well, I'm going to lose anyway. So
sure.
I'll just
Well, they're not trying to win. It's you know, they're just trying to improve.
Yeah, they're better. I'm just going to try things. I'm probably going to lose anyway, so I'll just try.
But they can't bring that mentality to a training situation with their peers.
Yeah.
With their peers, it's like, so they shy away from it. Or at least this is what, as a teacher, what I very much try to discourage my students, make sure they don't do. It's like that they don't shy away from that. That is just like, no, that's the best, that's the kind of training that you need. And again, talking about growth, is like what makes students grow in the best way possible is that they are sparring with people who are much better than them. They're sparring with people who are very close to their own level, and they're sparring with people that they are better than. And they know how to approach all three of those situations differently to get the most out of it. I imagine, you know, similar things.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, so when you are sparring with somebody who you are better than, you are much more experienced, much, you know, you are able to dominate them, but instead you approach that training situation in a way where you're just going to maybe decide, hey, I'm going to work on this technique that I'm not particularly good at. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to develop something new. I'm going to handicap myself. Because I can't, it's not productive for my partner for me to be training or to be fighting 100% right now. So I'm going to kind of handicap myself and use it as an opportunity to develop something that's a weakness of mine.
The thing is, and this, I feel like this, so if you go with somebody who's better than you and you try something that you want to add, it's probably not going to work anyway. And it's you're probably even not going to get to step one of it. So like that's
if they're better than you, I'm saying the opposite.
Yeah, yeah, but this is what I agree with you. But this is what I'm about to say to that is that. So then, in my opinion, you need to take the smallest part of what makes whatever you're trying to work on work,
mm-hmm,
and just try to get to that first step.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's like if you're like, hey, I know that I'm not going to be able to establish a jab because my jab is terrible against this person who's much better than me. But what's the first part of setting up the jab? Well, it's about managing the distance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, well, I need to make sure that I start by doing a good job of managing the distance against this person. Mm-hmm. And then it might be the next step might be like, okay, now that I'm doing a good job of managing the distance, I need to start establishing a good system where I get in and I get out.
Yep.
And then once you've add those two steps, then throwing the jab becomes easy. Mm-hmm. And I'm not much of a striker, so that might not make any sense.
No, that makes perfect sense.
But from a jiu-jitsu perspective, a grappling perspective, let's say I want to do let's say I want to do what's called a switch side armbar from Neon Belly or side mount. Mm-hmm. Well, first I need to consistently be able to figure out a way to isolate the far side arm. So, but I also need to understand Neon Belly and side mount control. So if I want to do that, I'm going to have to understand, okay, so how do I first make sure that I have good enough control that they can't escape? Now that I've established that, well, now the next step is how do I get this arm isolated? Because if they're just want to keep their arms in tight and I can't throw, in real life I might throw a punch, but the punch might not be there. If it's a sparring situation, I can't punch them. So how do I create this? And you figure out a way to create it. And it might be hopping up to Neon Belly, and when they go to push the knee, they expose the arm. Okay. It might be grabbing the lapel, or it might be driving your shoulder into their face to get that arm to consistently come out. And then you start hugging the arm consistently. And then you're like, okay, well, now I can hug the arm consistently. Well, these are things that can you can get on anybody if you do these first few steps.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, like, obviously, if you're much better than the person, you're not going to have a fear of, hey, if I spin and I miss it, I'm going to have a much larger period of time to react in some way to get back to the top or get to another dominant position or transition to a different sub. But if I'm going with somebody who's better than me, yeah, if I miss this, I'm probably going to end up on the bottom and might not get back on top. So you just need to understand that to begin with. And again, sort of adjust your expectations before you even start your training session with that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes back to what you're talking about from the beginning about just having a very clearly defined goal. You know, the first play, I think, is a good way, place to start that kind of stuff. I would say that the way that I would approach kind of the differences between, like, so the three, you know, sparring situations, sparring with someone who you are better than, sparring with someone who is on your, you know, similar level, and sparring with someone who is far better than you. I would say that what I've always used, you know, sparring with people who are better than me for is making the techniques that you are already good at even better. It, like, refines that technique. It's like, okay, you're able to make this work, you know, in competition, the division with, you know, your own peers. Yeah. Like that. It's like, now try to make it work against, like, the next level with guys. Like, I found that was useful. And then, you know, the other side of it is, you know, sparring with people who you are better than. You know, you're able to develop new techniques, but the ones that are the hardest and that you really need to keep that ego in check and not, you know, and be able to is when it's someone who it's like, and that's what I found with students that they'll often shy away from a little bit. It's like, they don't want, because then it's like there's a pride element to it. It's like, I don't want to get that loss.
And again, this is what makes everything with the arts incredible, is that each person is going to have their own unique spin and perspective on it.
Yeah.
So I know exactly what you're saying, and it depends what my goal is, but for the most part, I usually come in with a plan, and my plan is my plan.
Yep.
So it's like, if I'm working on this move, well, I know that I'm probably going to have more success on working on this move against these group of people than these group of people who are my training partners. Yep. So it might just be enough to get into the position against the guys that I know are going to just break it down and crush it, but at least I'm building a consistency in finding the position.
Yeah.
And the other guys, it's like, okay, I'm going to be able to get to the position and start to work through the next steps that I want to get through. It might even hit it successfully. Mm-hmm. If I am making the decision that, hey, I am getting ready for competition, well, I focus on two things personally. I'm like, I'm either doing a session where I really cannot add any new skills. It's time to refine what I have. I make a decision of, am I training just for cardiovascular endurance, and then I'm not so concerned about whether I'm hitting moves successfully or not. I'm more concerned about keeping my heart rate up and keeping a heavy workload and a heavy pace.
Yeah.
So then it's more of probably what I'm going to encounter from the other person in a match, and it also has me ready to go. If I need to sprint in the match, I can.
Yeah. No.
But if I don't need to sprint, I don't have to worry about it because I have the cardio endurance that I need. The other thing is that I'm like, I'm only going to focus on what I would call my A game.
Yeah.
So those are the two things I train when I'm getting ready for a competition. I'm like, so A game is, hey, I'm only going to do the moves that I know 100% and I know work really good for me. And if that move A fails, then I start to move on to move B. And move B is a move that I'm confident in, or I would use if they kill my move or react this way to my first move, I adapt and I move to this B move.
Yeah.
You know, and that to me, again, it all comes down to what's your goals, what's your mindset. But again, everybody has their own unique approach. just because that works for me doesn't mean it works for anybody else.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting one, talking about, like, you know, kind of manufacturing exhaustion in your training, you know, to the point that you know, like, training in a way that, like, you wouldn't in competition, because you're not trying to make yourself exhausted. Well, however, that's good conditioning.
So it's not even – so one of my things that I do, whether, and sometimes it's a bad thing, is I always try to make sure that I am not as tired as whoever I'm training with. Mm-hmm. It's, like, a huge thing for me.
Yeah.
Is that I always want to make sure that the other person is more tired than me.
Yeah.
Sometimes to my detriment, because sometimes I don't try hard enough for things. I give up on things way too easily.
Yeah.
But it's something that I pride myself on, because I'm like, okay, my successes are not based off any athletic gifts and not based off being in shape. It's based off being technical.
Yeah.
But if I'm getting ready for competition, I want to know that I have the ability to, if I need to amp it up for some reason or something happens where the pace goes crazy, sure, that I'm in enough shape that it doesn't matter. So I have it there.
Yeah.
If I need it. So sometimes I just go, okay, I'm going to train. I just want to train to, this is just a cardio session.
Yep.
I don't care what happens, as long as there's no resting and no pausing so I can get my heart rate up and do the cardio. Because the reality is that going for a run, hopping on a Aerodyne bike, as terrible as those things are, I don't know if you've ever been on one of those Aerodyne bikes. No. They're those fan bikes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I've been on them.
Yeah, sled pushes, whatever, sprinting, long distance running, long distance biking, whatever it is, swimming. It'll build your cardio up, but it's a different sort of cardio than you get from actually training.
Yeah.
So it's like sometimes maybe, and again, this works for me and it's something that I like doing. It's like,
sure,
I'm just like, this training session is just cardio.
Yep.
And sometimes, like, this training session is just A game stuff.
Yeah.
This training session is, I don't really care what happens in the other positions, but I'm really focused on, I don't want anybody to pass my guard.
You know, it's funny what
I don't
want
to be on the bottom for this at any point today.
Sure.
If it happens, yeah, okay, I know what to do, but I want to try at all costs. I don't care if I borderline push myself so hard that I'm going to maybe throw up.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to be on the bottom at all during today's training session. And again, those are a little bit too broad goals, I think, in general.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need a broad goal.
Yeah. No, that, it's funny you were saying about endurance, though, about being very specific, too, that I was shocked at how sore I got the first time I ever did a 2-mile run.
Yeah.
Because, like, I at the time, I was in pretty good shape. I was training very consistently, everything like that. And something I would do to kind of, you know, to deal with the exhaustion with is you just stay in multiple rounds. You know, it's like back, you know, I was one of, you know, my teachers, you know, most advanced students. So it's kind of like when we would do sparring in class, like, I would just fight every round. I wouldn't, you know, like, I wouldn't take a break.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, like, stuff like that. So I could go forever, you know, with, you know, I could spar for a solid 90-minute class, staying in for, like, every round, doing, you know, karate sparring like that. But I did a 2-mile run, and the next day my body was smoked. Like, you know, like, I was really sore. And it just kind of made me understand, I think, the way that the human body works a little bit better, and that it, like, that you will get very specifically conditioned to the kind of exercise that you're doing. And once you change it, you know, it's that way. So I'm kind of a believer in it, that, like, I'm sure that running is a great thing to add to your training. I'm sure it does improve your cardio. But at the end of the day, it's just a different kind of cardio. Like, you have to be in for those rounds of sparring to get that kind of endurance. At least in my experience, anyway. I found that I could be in really good shape for karate specifically and not be in very good shape for other exercises.
Yeah, well, I think that's 100%, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I think it's a different kind of shape for sure. And then there's also, like, the pressure of it being even if it's controlled, it's still a violent thing. So you get a certain level of, like, adrenaline rush and dump that these other things don't give you.
Yeah.
Like, there's not going to be the same adrenaline rush and dump from, no offense to anybody doing some bench press or going and running a marathon, as there is from, hey, I'm going to go out and compete in this thing. Because it's like, hey, if something goes wrong and I get caught, I could end up getting hit with a strike that gives me a concussion.
Oh, sure.
I can end up getting hit with a strike that breaks my nose. I can get hit with a strike that breaks my orbital bone. I can get caught in a submission that, permanently, like, destroys my knee. There's no way any surgery is going to put it back together.
I recently watched a really good video where Chael Sonnen was talking about that, about, you know, how professional fighters handle, like, the anxiety of a fight, you know, the pressure with it. Yeah. And he talked about some, you know, different, you know, kind of method. I think it was Randy Couture had, like, a funny one, like, that he said that, you know, when you feel like that stomach drop and you start to feel like kind of uncomfortable, he said that what Chael Sonnen said was that this was one that never worked for him, but it was Randy Couture's way of doing it, was he just say, I must be excited. And he had like this, I guess, little like mental trick to kind of be like, they do it.
Everybody's different with
it. Yeah, like the adrenaline, I mean, the nerves, that's a huge part of any combat sport. I mean, the fact is,
you'll see people throwing up in trash cans.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm like, I've never felt like I need to throw up.
Yeah, I never have either. I've never been wise. But a lot of people, a lot of people do, though. They say they have to. That, like, a lot of people, like, they almost like they make like a routine of it. Like, yeah, I just got to throw up and I'm good. Then I'm good to go.
But, yeah, I mean, everybody's different.
But the nerves, yeah. I mean, and, you know, Rory Miller, again, talks about this in his books a little bit about how adrenalization works, because as bad as it is in competition, I mean, you know, the idea of, like, criminal attack is, like, you get, like, what they call the adrenaline dump, where – and I've experienced that once in my life where I've had, you know, like, adrenaline dump, and it was crazy. Hours after the fight, I was wired. Like, you know, I could, like – I was having trouble, you know, falling asleep, like, 5 hours later because – and it was – it's kind of like a highly sophisticated survival mechanism that your body has, that this idea, and it's my opinion from my experience with it, that it's like your body is generally putting itself like in the perfect state to run from a bear. Like, you know, it's like you, when you get that adrenaline dump like that, you're in the perfect physical and mental state where you can just run as fast as you can for as long as possible. Like that. And it will really sabotage you in competition if you're not able to get yourself under control. And Roy Miller talks about in his book that, like, that's what martial artists are doing in sparring and in competition, is you're trying to get yourself to that optimal level of adrenalization. That point when, you know, you have the heightened, you know, speed, power, reflexes, everything like that, without it being so much that you lose the motor control over your body's movements.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And they said that that's a big skill in competition that, in my opinion, you know, you can only learn through experience. I tell my students all the time that I competed in a lot of karate tournaments, and I was nervous at every single one of them. I don't know if there are people out there that can learn how to, you know, like, just like not be nervous in a high pressure situation like that. But what I found was, like, I would be nervous in every single one of those situations, but I just got better at performing even though I was nervous.
Yeah. I agree.
I saw you compete, though. You look really calm in there.
I'm
used to being on stages.
So my nerves are all just like the sitting in the back and looking and being like, oh man, I got 3 hours before I have to go.
Yeah.
But it's too long being left to my own thoughts. But the actual, once I'm like, oh, I'm going out there in a little bit, the nerves are all gone. And that's all from just comes from playing music.
I can imagine.
I got all the nerves out being nervous doing anything years ago from playing music and playing. I played to many concerts that were way, way, way more well attended than any jiu-jitsu event that I'm ever going to be a part of, at least.
He who understands the way broadly can see it in all things. All right. There you go. All right. Well, that was a fun talk.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, guys. I think we're going to start to transition to more of like a every other week sort of thing. So check out.
Yeah, we haven't been as consistent lately, but we've talked about it. We're going to try to make it so that every other week we'll have a new episode out for you guys. Yeah. And thanks a lot for listening, as always.
Take care.
Keep training, everybody.